And speaking of what is and is not for sale, our last headline comes from the world of economics. The stock market was all peaks and valleys last week. In good news, it seems the Federal Reserve has kept its stranglehold on inflation, but not so good, the numbers on consumer spending. The April tally showed that consumers spent slightly less than they did in March, and rising gas prices may account for some of that, but not all. For more, we're joined by economist and president of Last Word Productions, Julianne Malveaux. Julianne, how are you doing?
I'm wonderful, Fry, and you?
I'm doing great. So what about this consumer spending thing? I mean, you know, everybody who has a wallet goes out and buys stuff, but there's also something really important for our economy about spending. How important is consumer spending for the economy?
Consumer spending makes up about 71% of GDP. So when people don't spend money, our economy can't grow. It's an interesting paradox. We spend a lot of time talking about financial literacy, fiscal responsibility. And on the other hand, you get this message all the time, buy, 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 spend, spend, spend. Because if people don't spend, we won't see economic growth. And what we've seen in the past 5 years, Farai, really 3 to 5 years, is that spending has been buoyed up by people borrowing against their mortgages. Some people are spending on good stuff like maybe cars or college tuition, but other people are spending on junk. And we've seen all these bubbles in the mortgage market. We're seeing for people with not excellent credit, interest rates rising. And so a lot of people are cutting back. People are much more reluctant to refinance their homes just to get Monopoly money.
Now, what are the factors that affect how and when people spend? Because like you laid out beautifully, there's really this tension between what the economy needs, which is more money being pumped in, and what we may need as individuals, which is to, you know, clamp down on that spending.
We can see seasonality in spending around, you know, nearly 40% of our spending actually happens triggered to the Christmas holiday. So the 6 to 8 weeks around the Christmas holiday, Thanksgiving, Christmas, all in there, you see a disproportionate amount of spending. Another time you see spending bubble up is August, September, back to school. You'll see a little bit in the summer because of vacations. But, you know, people are manipulated by advertising and by needs. And at the same time, they're constrained by what their requirements are. One of the things I think people haven't explored enough when they look at spending for last month is what the tax implications were and whether or not people were paying a bit more in taxes, especially at the bottom.
What about gas prices? One of the things that people have some discretion over, but not always full discretion, is gas. A lot of folks feel like they absolutely have no other way to get to work. There's not always public transportation. But on top of it, there is that discretionary aspect to, are we going to drive to the relative's house for a summer vacation? Do you think that people are going to, with gas prices once again high, be willing to spend the extra dollars on gasoline?
We'll see as the summer comes up. I mean, summer is peak gas time. I mean, this is when people use a disproportionate amount of energy. As you say, people are driving to the relatives, driving to the beach, doing all those kinds of things. But it's only May 14th, and gas prices have already hit an all-time high, literally a historic or at least a decade-long all-time high. The last time gas prices were nearly this high, inflation-adjusted, was 1981. So when you think about that and you think about them going up, 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 there's some challenges. Now, there are those who say they think they'll spiral down, but in some places there is almost $4 a gallon. And they're still concerned about three things, about production in Nigeria, production in Iran, and what will happen to pipelines if we have a severe hurricane season. So if any of those things happen to be severe, we can count on prices to go even higher. As you say, Farai, I don't understand our country. You know, when I look at some of the things, some of the numbers, I truly get puzzled. We've been talking about energy shortages for how long? You know, for 30 years. And yet you go to some major cities and there's no reasonable public transportation system forcing people into their cars. We have done insufficient work on developing alternative energy sources. Oh, that was garbled, but alternative energy sources. And so again, it's like, did someone just wake up and let us know that this was a finite resource that our country is overusing? Just fast forward for to a decade. China is having its coming out party with the Olympics in Beijing. More and more people there are driving. Imagine that we have that increased competition for these energy resources from China, where now only 1 in 20 households has a car. But people are saying in 10 years, 1 in 10 households will. Now, just imagine all those folks competing with us also for this energy resource. And then you think about the fact that in Norway, gasoline costs something like $6.90 a gallon. Other countries price gasoline to subsidize public transportation to be energy responsible. But we don't.
Yeah,
we let the oil companies have their own way.
Well, that's definitely an issue that we're going to continue to talk about, particularly in light of the fact that we also do Africa Update. We talk about who is tapping into the mineral resources on the continent of Africa. And so I think it all ties in together, because when you talk about China, you're also talking about a nation that's investing in the infrastructure in Africa.
Absolutely.
Get any deeper into the economy, I want to bring up a very interesting point that came out in the news. Senator and presidential candidate Barack Obama appeared on ABC's This Week yesterday, and he had some interesting things to say about affirmative action. Let's take a listen.
My daughters should probably be treated by any admissions officer as folks who are pretty advantaged. And I think that there's nothing wrong with us taking that into account as we consider admissions policies at universities. I think that we should take into account white kids who have been disadvantaged and have grown up in poverty and shown themselves to have what it takes to succeed.
Julianne, the question here is, Senator Barack Obama is someone who has kids, black kids, who are advantaged economically and sociopolitically compared to many other people. He's, for example, a Harvard graduate. There's something called legacy, where his kids would have an advantage over kids who weren't the children of Harvard grads. So do you agree with him that affirmative action should be more class-based and less race-based?
If we look back at the purpose of affirmative action and we talk about closing racial economic gaps, class-based affirmative action would not advantage the African-American population significantly. You have a larger group of, as he refers to, white kids who are poor than you have of African-American and Latino kids who are poor. So while I do understand his comment about class, and Senator Barack Obama can certainly afford to eschew affirmative action given the legacy privilege that his daughters will have, I think we still need affirmative action. I think we all look forward to the day, Farai, when the playing field is level. But I think that those of us who are involved in higher education, who look at the issues of access, who look at any number of things, understand that the playing field is not level right now.
So you think that there still is an economic need, not just for individual African Americans to get access, but there's an economic need for this country to have affirmative action based on race?
Oh, absolutely. I think that you still see, if you look at any of the economic indicators from unemployment rate to wealth, you just go down the list of economic indicators, you find the African-American community lagging. Much of it, of course, does have to do with class and income. Some of it still has to do with race. You get these studies that say that, you know, Teresa is more likely to get a job than Tamika. And you understand that the race biases still exist, and affirmative action overcomes that. Now, understand what I mean by affirmative action. We don't open up the door and let Tamika into med school when she doesn't understand chemistry. But we do make sure that she has a fair shot at med school, and we try to figure out why a disproportionate number of African-American kids have difficulty on the MCATs. Is that the appropriate way to measure medical school admissions? But I still think that there is a need. The only way we are worldwide, we're globally competitive, is that we fully exploit our human resources. When we put people of color at the periphery of the economy just because of our biases, we're literally putting our country behind in an economic race that includes other countries that are doing so much more investment in education and in human resources. Affirmative action is a form of that kind of investment. The challenge always comes, Farai, when you begin begin to look at these issues at the college level, we should be investing so much more in K through 12 education, especially in our inner cities where there are phenomenal disadvantages because education is funded by the property tax. But that's, you know, that's a complex conversation, and affirmative action often becomes shorthand for a number of other things.
All right. Well, we are certainly going to stay on top of that and, of course, have been covering the cases where affirmative action has been outlawed in various states and municipalities. Julianne, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Julianne Malveau is an economist and president of Last Word Productions. She joined us from NPR's Washington, D.C. headquarters.